Welcome to Breaking Banks, the number one global fintech radio show and podcast. I'm Brett King.
And I'm Jason Henricks. Every week since 2013, we explore the personalities, startups, innovators, and industry players driving disruption in financial services.
From incumbents to unicorns, and from cutting-edge technology to the people using it to help create a more innovative, inclusive, and healthy financial future. I'm JP Nichols, and this is Breaking Banks.
The novel coronavirus isn't just a health pandemic. It's highlighting critical societal and economic issues. Nowhere is this more apparent than the Paycheck Protection Program. Today on the show, we talk about lessons learned from the last crisis, some of the lessons we should have learned but didn't, and how banks, fintechs, and regulators are responding. We have four guests. Zach Warmbrot, financial services reporter for Politico, talks to Brett and I about his view from Washington. In the second half of the show, Jill Castilla, CEO of Citizens Bank of Edmond, and Brandon DeWitt, CTO of MX, talk about partnership and how tech can help Main Street. And in the last part, Patrick Davis of the Community Reinvestment Fund, a nonprofit that acts like a fintech to bring lending to underserved communities. Today's show is brought to you by Jack Henry Digital, the pioneer and creator of personal digital banking that helps community FIs translate their trust and live local personal service meaningfully into digital channels for the first time. Jack Henry Digital helps community financial institutions strategically differentiate their digital offering from those of the megabanks, big techs, and fintechs. Here with Zach Warmbrot, financial service reporter for Politico, joining us today to talk about the view from Washington as we enter what feels like month infinity plus two of the COVID pandemic and ensuing economic meltdown.
Like
yeah, it's what day is it and what time is it? Is it happy hour yet? So Zach, take us back to 2008. You landed in DC to cover a different financial crisis. Does this feel like deja vu all over again?
Yeah, and thanks for having me, by the way. I really appreciate it. Yeah, I've been at Politico for covering financial regulation since 2012, specifically here. And I feel like this is the moment everyone in Washington has been kind of preparing for who deals with, you know, financial policy. It's been, you know, trying to set up the safeguards for the banking industry so there's, you know, not a huge financial calamity like we saw in 2008 and 9. And it's been pretty interesting so far to see, at least on the traditional banking side, things seem to be working okay. I mean, there's obviously been some Fed intervention in the markets, but I mean, I go back to like the last time I was on Capitol Hill, we were allowed to be out and about and, you know, watching a meeting with President Trump and the banks and, you know, Bank of America CEO, JP Morgan executives, they were all there saying, we are well capitalized, we're liquid, and we're here to help. And that's kind of how they jumped into this thing. You know, after years of kind of fighting these rules and regulations, it's now they're actually in a pretty good spot, I think, because of it.
What do you think was different, you know, this time? Is it actually the rules, you know, that were in place? Is it just speed? Were we better prepared in other circumstances as a result?
Yeah, I think the banks are in a much better position now just because they've had to undergo so many layers of new regulation, you know, since the United States enacted the Dodd-Frank Act in 2010. And the real focus of that law was to, you know, prevent a repeat of 2008. So in some ways, it was kind of, you know, backward looking at what led to the last crisis. But, you know, you do have, you know, banks are required to, you know, abide by much higher capital requirements now. There's requirements on, you know, what kind of liquid assets they hold in case of a crisis so they can, you know, have access to cash. And there's just been a general, you know, discouragement by the government and the regulators of banks taking the kind of risks they did that led up to 2008. So I think all that together, that's why you don't see a problem right now with the traditional banking system and the stability of it right now. I mean, we'll see how this thing evolves. But, you know, right now it's, you know, banks have a credible case to make that, you know, hey, we can continue lending. We could agree to disagree about how much they're actually helping consumers. And I get plenty of that on both sides. But it definitely seems like you can't say that there's currently any banking crisis.
Yeah, I'd agree. I think it's very interesting to see Jamie Dimon came out and said in the last week or so that we've got to fix this problem of inequality. You know, I'm a big fan of Will Durant, you know, lessons from history, where he talked about the fact that if you look at the sort of level of inequality we're experiencing now in the United States, that whenever we've seen that level of inequality historically, it typically ends up in revolution, either a sort of political revolution or overthrow of the status quo, or a self-imposed revolution where you reform things to adjust inequality. And so the financial crisis has really emphasized that. But from a policy perspective, even though we've been discussing socialism and its impact on the US economy and, you know, infrastructure and things like that, we seem to be a long way from really addressing the fundamental causes of inequality. What do you think the feeling is in Washington? Do you think there is a spirit of willingness to address that, or are we a long way from that?
No, I do think in the last few years, there's been a growing recognition of that. I mean, I would look specifically to the Federal Reserve. You know, if you look at, you know, going back to Chair Yellen, I mean, she was one of the first Fed chairs to really talk about this issue of inequality. And, you know, the Fed has been under increasing political pressure to really acknowledge that issue. You know, there was a movement that started a few years ago. It was called Fed Up. And it was kind of a coalition of labor interests and then other, you know, advocacy groups that, you know, was solely focused on, you know, making the Fed look at income inequality and how, even though there was an economic recovery over the last crisis, it hadn't really reached everyone in the country, and there were still people being left behind. And this really kind of, you know, ramped up when the Fed was starting to raise interest rates again, you know, kind of towards the end of Yellen's term. But it's carried over to Chairman Powell. And I think if you look at some of his comments, I mean, he's very, I think he definitely agrees with that point of view that the economic recovery that we just had was uneven. You know, the Fed's put out research on how, you know, it didn't reach people of color in particular. And so I think, at least in that kind of part of the financial policymaking world, that's definitely been heard. And obviously in Congress, I mean, you have so many leaders on this issue, whether it's, you know, Senator Elizabeth Warren or Sherrod Brown, both of whom are on the Banking Committee. I mean, this is obviously a big issue for them as well. And so, you know, if the White House flips, they'll have a bigger say in economic policy. And so you could see this become even more of a front burner issue.
And we saw that inequality play out at a different level when it comes to the Paycheck Protection Program. And that's the inequality within the banking system itself in terms of level of access. You know, the big banks getting a priority and a heads up, being able to, you know, submit loans faster and electronically and hearing, you know,
for the biggest clients.
Yeah, for the biggest clients, right? It seems like the system itself propagated some of this. I'm curious what the temperature was as it relates to, you know, we then saw, you know, the SBA come out and creating a window where only the smallest banks could be submitting, and a certain level of agita against the biggest banks who, you know, were doling out the millions of dollars to some of their biggest customers. You're curious on your perspective there.
Yeah, I mean, this has really been the big tension at the heart of the Paycheck Protection Program since it started. I was covering it before it even launched on April 3rd, and I have very vivid memories of that morning of immediately getting angry emails from Bank of America customers saying, why can't I apply for a loan through my bank that, you know, had been telling me in the days ahead of time I could? And I mean, it's just from the go, there were just immediate, you know, problems with people feeling like they were left behind, especially the smaller businesses. And so I think that really kind of took on a life of its own. And then when you added, you know, disclosures that, you know, Shake Shack or Ruth's Chris has gotten the loans, that added a whole nother dimension to it. And so it really created this sense that the program was doing more to serve bigger companies than mom and pop shops. And I think if you look at the data, you know, it's a more complicated picture. I mean, I think some of the larger companies, it's not like they got a majority of the money. I mean, and you can kind of look at the average loan size, which is somewhere around $100,000 now, but it really did kind of create that perception. And so the Trump administration obviously immediately, or not immediately, but a ways into that controversy, you know, reacted by, you know, outright discouraging big companies to take the money. But then that carried with it its own set of problems. Then you had smaller companies that were like, well, do I fall into the same bucket as these bigger companies that other had access to financing? Should I be giving the money back? I mean, I did some reporting on companies that were in that position. And so I think Washington is still trying to get its arms around how to deal with that perception. And it's become even more complicated now because there's plenty of money left. There's still about, you know, more than $100 billion left to fund loans. And so there's less of this scarcity problem that I think was really kind of underlying a lot of those concerns before. But, you know, when I hear lawmakers talk about this, I mean, it's increasingly about how do we get to underserved businesses? And, you know, Chairman Powell and Secretary Mnuchin appeared before the Senate Banking Committee a few days ago. And, you know, this is a question that they kept getting with regards to the Paycheck Protection Program, as well as, you know, the upcoming Main Street Lending Program that the Fed is going to do, which is targeting some, you know, more mid-sized companies. And so, you know, policymakers are trying different ways to do it. I mean, you mentioned, you know, the SBA at one point shut down the PPP to anybody but the absolutely smallest banks. So that's been the method people have tried, you know, the administration and Congress have formally tried so far, is to kind of funnel more loans through smaller lenders because there's a belief that they'll be able to reach the underserved communities more. But we'll see if that was the most effective way to do it. I mean, everyone is just kind of like scrambling in emergency mode and seeing what sticks.
I want to change tack a little bit here, Zach, and I don't know how familiar you are with this, but one of the issues we have for financial inclusion in the United States is that basic access to banking, one of the reasons we have a fairly significant percentage of the population underbanked in the US or unbanked in the United States, is lack of access to the identity requirements that you know, get them to open a bank account. So one of the big issues here is, and it sort of plays into the whole fintech piece, is that the Community Reinvestment Act, the CRA from 1977, has, you know, fairly strict mandates around how branches should be put in place to give access to financial inclusion or give access to banking. And yet today, of course, we see the digital drive being a strong play, you know, elsewhere in the world. But the US hasn't quite caught up to this. And part of the real problem is this CRA. Now, we've been talking about CRA reform for years, but when it comes to its role in respect to financial inclusion and the other tools we have to create inclusion today that are sort of frustrated by this, when do you think we're going to get some real bipartisanship on CRA reform?
That's a great question. And that was obviously in the news this week because you had the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency come out with its, you know, they called it a final rule for reforming the Community Reinvestment Act. But you know, there's kind of an asterisk next to that because the other top banking regulators didn't go along with it. So, you know, you didn't have the FDIC come out with its rule. The Fed's not endorsing the plan and coming out with its own rule yet. And I think that speaks to your question, which is it's going to be a long time before there's bipartisan agreement and consensus on a real set of changes to that law. I mean, and if you look at the Fed, I mean, that's, you know, I think it was easier for the OCC to do it because that's, you know, the controller Otting, Joseph Otting, who was running that agency and is now stepping down, you know, he could act more unilaterally. But if you look at the Federal Reserve, for example, I mean, the Board of Governors, you know, you have people with different perspectives and you have, you know, Governor Brainerd, who worked at the Obama administration and has been working on this issue. And so the Fed is really kind of a consensus-driven organization. And I think it's just going to be some time before that's accomplished, especially if you kind of look at the timeline of where we are, you know, in terms of the shift in power in Washington. I mean, this is, you know, so it's, you know, a few months before the next election. This is the time when, you know, agencies kind of finish up their work and it's kind of pins down. And there's legal reasons for that, because if they, you know, there is another CRA, it's called the Congressional Review Act, which basically during like the last few months of an administration, you know, the next Congress could nullify those rules within a certain window. So I just think it's not going to get done anytime soon. I think this will continue to be debated and we'll see, you know, what happens in November. If Democrats consolidate power across, you know, the executive branch and Congress, maybe something could happen. If it's still divided government, I'm a little suspect of that.
Where do you see?
Yeah, I think I agree with you there.
Yeah, I think we're all in violent agreement that we're kind of in the stuck zone. And regardless of where we end up, you know, divided or unified in terms of a party, when are we going to see technology take on more of a prominent role? It's, you know, we keep seeing the this fits and starts of, hey, the
FinTech,
you
know, charter, yeah,
exactly. FinTech charter, stop. Office of Innovation, stop.
OCC, you know, versus Fed, yeah.
Yeah, you know, and we can't get unified. When are we going to, or what are you even hearing, you know, people rally around it? Because when we talk about, you know, efficiency and inclusion, and the two seem to go together quite often, technology has to play a major role.
Yeah, and I think from my perspective in Washington, you know, a lot of these issues get wrapped up in inter-industry squabbles. So I think this is one area where I've increasingly seen over the last year, you know, some of the larger banks are kind of looking around the corner and they're wondering, well, is Google or Amazon going to get into this business? Do we need to be maybe put on a little bit more of a defensive posture? I mean, because they, you know, there's been companies like, you know, Rakuten from Japan, the e-commerce company, you know, they were seeking an ILC charter through the FDIC, and other companies have been doing that increasingly. And I just think that, you know, part of the dynamic there is you're going to have some of the traditional banks trying to keep some of these tech companies at bay in terms of getting a foothold, you know, in terms of regulatory licenses and things like that. And then they have their allies in Congress. So it's, you know, it's not just the industry itself. And you all maybe could speak to this, but it just seems like there's a real question now about kind of the future of the fintech industry itself right now, especially at this point in time with the economy and the shape it's in. I'll just be curious to see, you know, how many of the players on that side of the equation will be left standing and kind of driving this discussion.
Well, Jason and I both run fintechs. Right now, of course, you know, I've got a fintech which we have fortunately got PPP funding, and that's been very helpful for us. We're good into next year. Some of the bigger fintechs, the challenges that have come into the market, of course, are pretty well funded, like N26 and Monzo and Revolut that are coming in. But, you know, we saw these shenanigans, if you like, with the Walmart, when Walmart tried to get into banking, right? There was a lot of efforts by incumbents to slow that. And that's the reason why Walmart couldn't acquire a bank account. But compared with markets, other, you know, financial centers of the world, like Shanghai, Hong Kong, Singapore, London, you know, the US is significantly behind the rest of the world on regulatory reform around banking charters, you know, and that will ultimately result in the US market, you know, falling behind unless the VC effect of Silicon Valley, you know, and Silicon Alley to some extent as well, sort of really pushes these, you know, or allows these fintechs to compete. But the problem you've got in the US versus, say, London is the amount of capital you need in the United States to be really successful as a fintech, say, as a challenger bank, to compete with the incumbents is a lot more than what you'd need in, say, Europe because of that fintech charter. And it takes a lot longer. We've seen, of course, the guys at Varo have just got their first, you know, pure play digital license. And there's probably going to be some legal challenges to that from incumbents, my guess is, although, you know, they've got it now. So, but it took 2.5 years, whereas, you know, you can do that process in Hong Kong in 90 days, you know. And so that's a real structural issue. But it's not just happening in banking licenses. Look at the way we do payments. You know, we haven't had reform on, you know, point of sale and, you know, very basic things. Look at what China's doing with facial recognition for payments now, which is really relevant in coronavirus. So there is a sort of broader issue of incumbents that want to protect their business, and most of the biggest banks in the US, they've done some digital stuff, but their primary business model and org chart KPIs is pre-digital. Yep. And so, you know, you're going to have that gap, but yeah, that's my observation.
Yeah, and there's one more element too. I mean, and you brought up payments. I mean, one of the big things I covered last year was the rollout of Libra. the Facebook cryptocurrency payments product. And I think that just revealed that in Congress, there is a deep skepticism of some of these technology companies getting involved in finance, and especially the larger ones. I mean, it was Facebook's baggage that just created a huge controversy around that product. And I really do think it kind of, that will bleed over into other, you know, financial technology entrants as well. And yeah, I if you look at, like, you know, the chairwoman of the Financial Services Committee, Maxine Waters, I mean, just deeply skeptical of the risks to consumers, you know, by having some, you know, technology companies in this space. And so I don't think you can, you know, I think that's part of the reason why the US might be moving more slowly than other countries, is just the political dynamics.
Well, yeah, I think, you know, there's that whole angle of regulatory reform. You know, we've got so many regulators in the United States that cover payments, banking, and so forth. You know, just even when it comes to a charter, you got OCC, Fed, FDIC, then you got the state.
I was going to say, don't forget the state level.
Yeah, and there's no signs of reform of that sort of regulatory structure, which makes it very difficult to move, to change. So, like, the OCC Fed friction there, you know, what's all that about? And don't even get me started, CFPB, right?
I mean, there's just been running jokes since the financial crisis, you know, because in the US, there's a Securities and Exchange Commission and a Commodity Futures Trading Commission. They both regulate financial markets. And, you know, it'd be really, you know, a lot of, you know, people have thrown around, why don't we just merge these two agencies? They basically look at,
I saw a Twitter capital market the other day.
Yeah. But it gets to, like, the reason it doesn't happen is because there are two different committees in Congress that have jurisdiction over those. And it's the agriculture committees that have jurisdiction over the CFTC, and they're just never going to give that up.
Yeah.
Like, there's always these kind of, like, political interests that, you know, are slowing down these things that may look like they could create efficiency. I mean, it's just, you know, it's one thing after another. But on the other hand, too, I mean, you have multiple, you know, in terms of the multiple banking agencies, yeah, I guess you could argue you have multiple eyeballs on things and differences of opinion. And, you know, maybe it's better sometimes that things don't move more quickly, you know, in terms of consumer protections, but it's obviously a trade-off.
Except if we're not moving at all, you know, consumer protection also means consumers are being left behind because we're not seeing new products, right? We're living in a different century practically. You know, forget decade. We're not even changing some of the products into the ways.
Like even credit scoring for access to credit. I mean, there's so many better ways to do that right now, but it's just like embedded feature of the system that's so difficult to change.
Yeah, and we'll see how things shake out after the pandemic. I mean, I feel like there's just going to be all kinds of consolidation that could be coming with all these different players. You know, the political ramifications, I still think we're figuring it out. So I'm kind of, you know, it seems like in other parts of life, there's so many, like, rapid changes happening about, you know, how we operate digitally versus, you know, in the physical, you know, with physical retailers and such. And I'm kind of wondering if there could be some kind of acceleration in the financial space on that too.
Well, so with the remaining few minutes, oh, go ahead, Brett.
Yeah, no, I was just going to give you one quick question. How do you think, given that, given the politics of that, one of the things that's likely to occur coming out of coronavirus is less bank branch activity. So, you know, how do you think that's going to affect the political climate? Because clearly branches are going to decline. There's a digital replacement, but, you know, what's the attitude or, you know, inclination towards that shift?
I mean, I still feel like there are people in Washington who would like to support those branches just to, you know, kind of like we were getting back to, you know, serving communities that may be underserved. And so I think that pressure will continue to be there. And I mean, and it seemed like, isn't it right that, you know, JP Morgan and Wells Fargo have been expanding their branches? I mean, isn't there some kind of, you know, market interest in doing that as well?
Yeah, there's a little bit, but they're also reducing square footage and replacing branches and stuff like that. So there's a bit of, you know, games in terms of,
it's a total shell
game. Stock market. Yeah.
Yeah.
Total. Whereas on average, they're down about 15% from 2008, those big guys. So
Zach, I'm curious, last few minutes here, with your crystal ball on, you know, where do you see, from a policy perspective, the biggest potential for changes coming up in the near future?
I think right now the biggest story in banking in terms of Washington policy is just how can we get the banks to support small businesses in particular. I mean, we've seen that with the PPP. That's still a work in progress. And I think more is going to come out. I think the banks are going to face a lot of scrutiny about the decisions they made, about who they served and how. And I think there'll be more hearings and investigations into that. I mean, the next big thing coming up, like literally in the next couple of weeks, is the launch of the Main Street Lending Program. That's the Federal Reserve facility that was trying to encourage banks to serve more of the mid-sized companies. And I'm already hearing concerns from lenders about how that's going to work. And, you know, if there will even be demand for those loans, which the banks, unlike PPP, the banks will actually have some skin in the game for those loans, even though they'll still have some government backing. So, you know, that could be a whole other set of issues. You know, I think there's probably going to be more scrutiny about how, you know, fintech companies performed during this as well. I mean, I've done a little bit of reporting on a company you probably know called Lendio and Ready Capital, which, you know, kind of rushed to issue, you know, to approve, you know, tens of thousands of these PPP loans and then left consumers waiting for weeks. And, you know, I'm still kind of wondering from a Washington perspective, is this moment where fintech companies jumped in, is this going to help or hurt their cause here? And I think just in general, the health of the financial industry, I mean, kind of like we were talking to at the beginning of the conversation, did the rules that were put in place in 2010 to avert the next meltdown, are they actually working? Are the banks in as good a shape as they are saying? Will there have to be any regulatory intervention to prop them up? So yeah, I think it's just like with everything, it's a little bit uncertain, but that's kind of what I think the near-term issues are.
Great. Well, Zach, we really appreciate you joining us on the show today. It's been very insightful. Can I just ask, you know, obviously we can go to politico.com to check out your latest musings, but where else can people find out about yourself?
Yeah, just follow me on Twitter. It's at Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y. And I'm posting daily about the PPP and other issues that we talked about now. So
well, that's great. It also shows you were an early adopter of Twitter, given that you got that great Twitter handle. So we really appreciate it. Make sure you check out politico.com. It's time for us to go to a break. After the break, we're going to hear from our friends at MX. But you're listening to Breaking Banks. Thanks, Zach, for joining us on the show this week.
Thank you for having me.
We'll be right back after these brief words from our sponsors. Jack Henry is a great supporter of Breaking Banks. Jack Henry Digital is the pioneer and creator of personal digital banking that helps community financial institutions translate their trust and live local personal service meaningfully into digital channels. Jack Henry Digital also helps community financial institutions strategically differentiate their digital offerings from those of the mega banks and the big tech and fintechs. How do they do it? Well, it's with their Banno digital platform, a complete 100% API-enabled open digital banking platform. You get lightning-fast native apps, integrated PFM, you get cloud-based core-connected back-office tools for employees, and with the website marketing and content management capabilities built into their community, you can launch, track, and target campaigns quickly from click-through to product acquisition. Don't forget to also check out Banno Conversations, a first-of-its-kind, fully authenticated, secure chat capability that enables branch staff to connect digitally with customers. You want to check it out? You really have to see this in action. Visit banno.com to schedule a demo today. That's B-A-N-N-O.com. For e-commerce business, if you're working on the e-com space, shipping in 2 days or less is the new standard. As a growing business, how can you keep up? Well, this is where Shippo comes into play. Now, Shippo is the only shipping software for growing businesses that you can set up in minutes starting today. They ship hundreds of millions of packages. They offer volume discounts up to 90% off the typical carrier rates. And they do this by doing bulk ordering with carriers like UPS, USPS, FedEx, and DHL. Your orders are automatically pulled in from your system and into Shippo. They have automated return labels that are free. You only pay if your customers use them. And companies that use Shippo are already saving thousands of dollars. And on average, you can grow 70% a year over year with your shipping capabilities with their platform. Over 100,000 companies are using the service. For our listeners, they're offering their best discount available anywhere. Get a shipping consultation and Shippo Pro Plan 6-month trial for free at goshippo.com/fintech. That's up to $700 worth of value for free at goshippo.com/fintech. That's goshippo.com/fintech. Go right now, get your free shipping consultation and pro plan 6-month trial. Now's not the time to be heading out to the drugstore because you forgot to replace your razor. Harry's knows sometimes it's better to stay inside. That's why they ship directly to you, so you can experience the quality of a Harry's shave in just a few days from the convenience of your own home. And you know what? I've been using this product for a few weeks now, and the blades are great. They get their own blades from a German blade factory that Harry's work with. But better for me is the scent of the shave gel. It smells great. And when I come out of the shower, Katie's always going, "You smell good. What have you got on?" And it's a shave gel. It just smells great. Join the 10 million people who have tried Harry's. Claim your special trial offer by going to harrys.com/fintech. Refills are available directly to your door. They're 100% quality guarantee, and 1% of the proceeds are set aside for nonprofit organizations devoted to helping provide access to better healthcare for men and veterans. Listeners of my show can redeem their Harry's trial set at harrys.com/fintech. You'll get a weighted ergonomic handle for a firm grip, a 5-blade razor with a lubricating strip and trimmer blade, rich lathering shave gel with aloe to keep your skin hydrated, and a travel blade cover to keep your razor dry and easy to grab on the go. Check it out. Go to harrys.com/fintech to start shaving better today.
Welcome back to the second half of Breaking Banks. Now, in the first half with Zach, we talked quite a bit about inclusivity and how the Paycheck Protection Program was really having some impacts on the have and have nots. And there's nowhere the have and have nots portion of financial services can be felt more is often in the technological experience, that the big banks with big budgets are able to deliver one set of experiences. And well, then a lot of times it can be the everyone else if they don't have that same access. And so very pleased to have Brandon DeWitt, co-founder and CTO of MX, as well as Jill Castilla from Citizens Bank of Edmond, to talk about PPP as well as technologically, how did they approach it? Now, Brandon, at the MX FinTech Festival at Sundance this year, you gave a talk on the nobility of banking, and the backstory is amazing. And I would love if you can, you know, share a little bit of the essence of that talk, because I've got to tell you, this is one of, you know, to say a handful of times is an exaggeration, that I've actually been at a banking conference and see people move to tears, that it hasn't been out of boredom, but you know, it really did have that impact to hear your story. So can you share a little bit of that with us now?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm certainly glad it wasn't out of boredom. But you know, we all kind of have our journey that led to where we are. And I think oftentimes our journey, you know, leads us sometimes to our purpose. And so my journey to where I am started out, you know, in banking, but really in the credit side, and like, you know, helping get credit products into people's hands, working for Baker Hill and then Experian and a couple other companies like that. So a few years ago, actually 4.5 years ago, we were going through our journey at MX. We were a much smaller company, had a much smaller footprint. And actually on my 33rd birthday, got diagnosed with stage 4 cancer and told that I had less than 90 days to live. And so, you know, I think we all have this, you know, relationship with mortality, that we're going to live forever and we can push off to tomorrow what we may find important. And so, you know, it's one of those moments in your life where everything comes into focus and you get to see what rises to the top of the priority list. And my journey at that time, in fact, just happened to be wearing a Dana-Farber jacket this morning, but I went out and got treated at Dana-Farber in Boston, and that didn't work. And then I got treated at Fred Hutch in Seattle. Again, continually being told that I'm on death's door. feeling like I'm on death's door, if you've ever been through the cancer journey. And even today, I'm on chemotherapy 5 days a week and getting an infusion every 3 weeks now up at Huntsman Cancer Institute here in Utah. But one of the things that allowed me to do was just take a collection of where I was in life and what I was doing and what I was doing it for. And so it led to a lot of conversations about, you know, what's the purpose of your journey and what are you getting after and how are you spending your time? Because really time is this, you know, priceless resource that we all have. And if you're not focusing on something that is lifting up yourself or lifting up others in some way, then I think that your time is being ill invested. And so, you know, through that journey, I you know, really felt very strongly that what we were doing at MX was the right thing and the purposeful thing for me to be doing. But I think that it helped reset the focus of priorities. And so, you know, we have these aphorisms that we talk about at MX all the time. But at that point in time, one of the aphorisms that we started, you know, circulating around MX was purpose before profit. And so, and mission before margin. You start thinking about how on a daily basis when somebody is thinking about how they're executing their job and what they're doing day in and day out and how they're serving others, how do they bring into focus the idea that like we shouldn't worry about these other things because they are not leaders, they're followers. So let's not worry about the margin, let's not worry about the profit, let's not worry about all those other things, but those are followers, they're not leaders. And let's put the right kind of priority at the very top of the stack. And that meant that we, you know, lived through service. And I believe that very strongly. I think as I've really, you know, dug into this space and said, okay, well, if we're going to lead this way and if we're going to talk this way, then like who else has done this and how has this been done in the past? And how could we, you know, choose the right vocabulary and choose the right things to aim for? And I was surprised to find that, you know, the first banking organization of the Western world was called the Knights Templar. And we all know the Knights Templar as this kind of like, you know, warring organization. But the fascinating thing about it is in order for you to actually join the Knights Templar and be a steward of interest-bearing bank accounts, you had to take a vow of poverty. And so they understood the seriousness of what it meant to be a steward over a community and over the finances of a community and over interest, you know, bearing products, and said, this is so important that we absolutely know that you have to take a vow of poverty to have this type of stewardship. It's that important in a community. And as I've just been like, you know, on this journey in my own life, I have discovered that time and time again, that has come up in our history. I mean, one of my favorite Thomas Jefferson quotes is, I am more fearful of interest-bearing bank accounts than I am of any standing army. And like, I mean, it's just incredible to imagine that like these people that we look up to, you know, as you know, wonderful founders of our country and things that, you know, we believe very strongly in today, also knew that the stewardship that we have in the financial community is one of the most powerful things out there. And I think with this new layer of technology, as you know, you kind of bring in this idea that technology has been optimizing and automating everything out there, there's now a new layer of stewardship. Like, how does that play into our communities? How do we, you know, set the right priorities and have the right types of purposes behind that? You know, a little bit just about the kind of end of that story, I guess, for me, you know, I'm still on my journey, but I have substantially outlived any prognosis that I've ever had. Almost all of my tumors have disappeared. At one point in time, I had 18 tumors throughout my lungs and my head and my neck. And almost all my tumors have disappeared. And I am a product of a wonderful set of scientists and doctors who have, you know, chosen to pursue solutions to cancer. And that is another stewardship in our society that's incredible. But even if you're, you know, what I learned is even if you're not a scientist, a doctor on the cutting lines, you know, cutting edge of what's going on there, your stewardship, your purpose can make a meaningful difference. And I fundamentally believe that like, as we worked up, you know, to that, as we were prepared to like take on that stewardship, something happened in our world, a pandemic happened, and all of a sudden PPP was this magnifier of this problem. Yeah. All of a sudden, we're going to have this massive disparity. Those who have access to, you know, these large financial, you know, instruments or something like that, and those who are employing the folks in our community across the United States and don't have access to that capital and need it desperately. It's one of those times in which, you know, you feel like all the preparation and all the coincidence have come to a point. And as a technologist, you just say, yeah, I might be able to help. And so, like, let's try and jump in and help as much as possible. And you saw that happen throughout the banking sector in general.
Brandon, I can't think of a better word to describe Jill than steward. I'm glad you had brought that up. It's not a stewardship, and steward is not something that often comes on a show around disruption and technology and fintech, but I can't think of a better word than Jill. Like, you literally wear that on your shirt. Let me guess, you probably do have one of your Main Street companies. No? Well, I should have looked at the video first, but Jill is known for, like, literally wears the t-shirts of the Main Street businesses up and down because she believes so strongly in the power of community. And yep, there it is, in supporting, you know, the companies that surround her, that make up her community and that make up her customer base. And, you know, it was really evident in PPP, you know, you threw everybody you had against that first wave. And was able to watch that kind of by hook and by crook, you were able to get that done. As you were preparing for the second wave, you partnered with MX. How did that go? You know, this idea of stewardship, but it's tech-powered stewardship, is a pretty powerful one.
Well, I love what Brandon was saying is that it wasn't me throwing everyone at PPP. That's what our organization is. And so they were all doing this on their own accord, contributing, you know, hundreds of hours of their own personal time on the weekend in the middle of the night, because they knew that we were those economic first responders to these small businesses and that no one else was coming. You know, we were the only ones there to help. We had to. If we didn't step up, no one else was going to do it. And so I love everything about what MX, that sense of purpose, what they were saying, and then part of what Citizens is, our mantra is, if we do good, we'll do well. And so PPP really encapsulated all of that as our ability to really prove, are we the type of company that steps up even whenever there isn't economic benefit for the institution as a result of it. And so, and the forces of this crisis have really brought together like-minded companies in a way that I've never seen before. And so I don't believe it's an accident that MX and Jason and Alloy Labs and Mark Cuban and other contexts have come together and to be able to act as those stewards to our different communities and to the nation as a whole. So first round of the Paycheck Protection Program, I did a call asking for a fintech partnership, knowing that we could fill, and we had proactively, the bank had called all of our business customers to see what their financial condition was, what we could do to help them. We were deferring payments for the vast majority of those small businesses before PPP was launched. We were also on the front lines of the CARES Act to try and get that developed. So we knew the challenges that access we were going to have, because the SBA has it where if you don't use their portal for 30 days, then they restrict your authorization. So we knew we could see all these compounding problems and knew that we needed some type of partner to help us through it. The first round of PPP, we didn't have that partnership with MX. We actually had another fintech that helped us and continued to help us through both rounds, which was invaluable to us, but we still couldn't help everyone. And what we found was that the most sophisticated borrowers were at the front of the line, and maybe those that maybe didn't need PPP as badly, but those that needed the tourniquet apply, that really needed that triaging to ensure their survivability, they needed a lot of hand-holding through the process, and that the money was out before they were able to get a completed application done because of the supporting documentation requiring things like that. So once the money was gone, we had these reserves of struggling businesses that were desperate for money. And whenever we saw that PP2 was going to be underway, fortunately, we had this partnership with MX where they basically said, let us help you. We can get what we were struggling with. We only have 55 team members in our entire bank, which some fintechs are like, I mean, that's a lot of people, 55 people to throw at PPP. But, you know, we're also running a drive-through and a branch operation and, you know, our normal course of business as a bank. And so we probably had about 14, 15 people that were truly dedicated to the Paycheck Protection Program. And we still, because of the limited access availability to the SBA, we're struggling to get those. Once we had a completed application, getting it uploaded to the SBA was our point of contention. MX allowed us to take all those files that were completed and to be able to use one single access. That access was very precious to us, as we only had like three or four available for our entire bank there for a while, and that they could really maximize the utilization of that one access to the SBA to submit applications. And it freed up our team to then focus on the customer, to be able to then usher them, serve as an advisor to them to get these completed applications done so that they could get accessibility to the liquidity that they desperately needed.
Well, and you bring up a really good point there, because technology is so often seen as the enemy of this idea of having a personal relationship with your banker. But what you just described is that actually technology empowered them to do what, you know, technology couldn't, which is usher them through. And I'm sure in some parts even act as their emotional counselors. They're worried about their business going away if they don't get this money, because they don't have that level of sophistication.
Right. We believe that technology, financial technology, shouldn't be a replacement for what we do, but it should elevate and be able to be something that we leverage to be even a better community banker, to provide a more intimate relationship with the customer, because you've got the technology that's allowing for greater efficiency and greater effectiveness and sometimes greater counsel.
So, Brandon, inclusivity has become one of like the archstones within MX. How it has, like, your personal journey, I think, has been a big part of that razor sharp focus on inclusivity. What's your vision about how technology fits in both with people and this broader theme of inclusivity?
I mean, you know, like to what Jill was just saying, I mean, technology can be used in many different ways, right? So it can be used to, you know, automate or take away jobs, or it can be used to, you know, magnify and make opportunities like more and more clear and make them more and more pertinent. And it can empower a connection with community. And it all just depends on, you know, to what you were saying, Jason, is like, where are you actually, you know, going to focus and what are you going to press on? And that, I think that's probably the big thing that is a differentiator, is whatever you put out there as your charge as an organization, the people in your organization will pursue. And so, like, something that I find very unique and refreshing about what we did during the PPP portal time was we went out and we said, hey, we can host this for you. We can, you know, help you with this process. We can do all this other stuff. But also, all of the source code is going to be open source. Anybody can have it. Anybody can leverage it for anything that they want. They can change it. They can edit it. They can do anything they want with this source code. And so there is this, you know, thing that's manifesting, I think, and even in our space of financial technology, that is largely kind of eschewed, you know, open source software, of how do we begin to have a more collaborative approach, and how do we begin to have a more collaborative approach that enables those interactions and that enables those opportunities to support and build our communities. And if we don't do that, then we are not going to have the communities that we want, and we are not going to have the industry that we want. And we have to be the creators of that industry. And so, like, you know, I think it is all of these things coming together, both the desire of an institution to take a risk, because quite frankly, you know, for Jill and her team, we are not a business lending company. And so for us to get on the phone and say, hey, we think we can help you, we're helping others, and we have this tool, and you can have the source code, and you can use it all you want, and you can do whatever you want with it, but we think we can help you, it's still, you know, a risk calculation that they have to do to say, you know, is this the right thing, the right people, the right time? And I think when you have the right mission, that sets that goal out there that you can all align to say, yes, this is the right thing with the right people at the right time. And if we can align to, we want to empower and enable these types of interactions, then we can align on everything else that we need to do. But by no means is, you know, MX coming in and saying we have a full-blown solution. We were day in and day out actively contributing, and the folks that, you know, tons and tons of banks took the source code and have built and used it internally and like powered their SBA portals with it and contributed back, you know, contributed code back to the central repository that we pulled in and bettered the solution for everyone. And when you watch that happen at scale, like that's where I feel honored to sit in the seat that I sit in, because I got to watch, you know, hundreds and thousands of people say, yeah, I'm going to be up in nights and weekends and I'm going to tweak this source code a little bit so it handles one more edge case. So it handles one more edge case so we can do something else. And I mean, it was an incredible privilege to just observe all that happening, but I hope that happens more and more in our industry. I think there's a massive opportunity for it that doesn't differentiate between the largest of the large with the most capital and those that are, you know, serving their community, but rather says there can be one solution that everyone can have access to that can help everybody.
So, Jill, as Citizens Bank of Edmond is looking forward and thinking about inclusivity, especially in the wake of the COVID outbreak and just the heavy emphasis you have on community, what else are your plans and your vision for what you can do more for the Herd on Herd crowd?
Well, we've been really focused, especially as PPP, there's the funding still available. The rush is not as much there. Our customers have been cared for, to now try to get into the sense of the Senate to ensure that those that were underserved that really were included in that sense of the Senate from the CARES Act are served through PPP and that they understand that there's not barriers to getting access to that credit. So I'm really proud that our team is, we are near 50% of the businesses that we funded being female-owned businesses, and we're well above 50% when you combine that with minority-owned businesses. It showed us that perceived barrier of access to credit is something that is a reality in a lot of communities, even just in our metropolitan area. So seeing that in action was something that I knew about that intellectually, that we heard those stories after stories about those potential barriers entering now are it's made a call of action for our team to ensure that we are consistent now going forward, that we can be a trusted advisor, not to just those that that look like us and that we have intimate conversations and relationships with as we walk down Main Street, but that we're able to go into the neighborhoods and small business communities that maybe don't have a bank in them. So that's been an unfortunate reality that's been exposed to us that we really feel called to step up and serve. You know, the ability to maintain those connections and have that high level of engagement, even as a bank, but even especially when you start getting into the community and ensuring that you're still an influencer and where a city is going and the welfare of those that populate it. It's more difficult as everything becomes more virtual and that we're not physically interacting with someone in the grocery store aisles. And so we've launched a virtual Herd on Herd so that we could have like at least an online engagement. So our team is really fortunate to be able to do that. Herd on Herd is our monthly street festival. We usually bring about 50,000 people to downtown Edmond. The bank puts it on our 55 team members, and it celebrates small business, local music and food trucks, and just as a kind of an old-fashioned a neighborhood party. But you know, how do we expand that reach to beyond just Edmonds downtown into some areas that maybe don't have a community bank that's able to lead that sense of engagement and that we're all in this together? And so, you know, that virtual Herd on Herd really helped us, I think, go beyond some barriers that we really didn't know were there, and something that we'll likely continue to leverage on and do more of going into the future.
Well, excited to see the results that great community bank with strong leadership and a tech company with strong mission and ideals were able to rally, you know, to help the smallest of the businesses. You know, for those who have listened to Breaking Banks for a while, Jane Barrett, the chief advocacy officer from MX, is on quite a bit. In fact, I don't know many software companies that have a chief advocacy officer talking about the mission and how they can use technology to help all sorts of people, the underserved, to, you know, the biggest of, you know, companies and users of data, but there's something for everyone there. So excited about this partnership. Check out mx.com. And Jill Castilla is best found on Twitter, is my favorite place to see what she has to say. So thank you both for what you did for our communities and for taking part in the show.
The SBA issued final guidance on the PPP loan forgiveness, but now there are more questions than answers. Like, what if the loan forgiveness process is such a pain that borrowers don't complete the forgiveness and the lender's stuck with a bunch of low interest loans? How do banks make sure they're 100% compliant when the feds come looking to review? AlphaRank helps answer all these questions by automating the entire process. It's sort of like a TurboTax for PPP loan forgiveness. There's no integration required. You just sign paperwork and start using AlphaRank's tools in less than 48 hours. And they're trusted by major financial institutions, and they've got partnerships with numerous state banking associations and the likes of MeridianLink. How do you get to check it out? Visit alpharank.io/Brett King to learn more. That's alpharank.io/Brett King. Mention you heard this ad on the Breaking Banks podcast and get a 20% discount.
When we talk about diversity and inclusivity, you know, it's easy to think about the un and underbanked that are common themes, and we think of those as individuals, but the same trend exists within small business. And those two things, you know, the consumer impact and the small business impact, was really felt when the Paycheck Protection Program, you know, was first launched and some of the response. And excited to have Patrick Davis, VP of Program and Strategy Development at the Community Reinvestment Fund USA, also known as CRF, on the show today. And they were founded in 1988 with a fund. It's a national nonprofit with a mission to empower people to improve their lives and strengthen their communities through innovative financial solutions. Patrick, can you tell us a little bit more specifically, what does that mean? How do you actually have this positive impact on communities and small businesses with the CRF fund?
Yeah, absolutely. And thanks so much for having me. So, you know, for our 30 plus year history, bringing access to capital to historically underinvested communities and people is really what we're all about. That's the ethos of the organization. We are structured as a supporting organization nonprofit. And we're also a certified community development financial institution under the U.S. Treasury. And there's about 1,000 organizations like CRF around the country that are really focused on serving the needs, the financial needs with products and services of the un and underbanked across the board, not just in small business, certainly in consumer as well, and certainly in affordable housing, project finance like childcare, clinics, community facilities like healthcare centers, et cetera. And so this is really sort of a shadow financial system without the negative connotation of shadow that serves the needs of those who are sometimes overlooked by other financial institutions and plays a really vital role in bringing access to capital to communities around the country.
Well, let's call it a spotlight, not a shadow organization.
I like it.
Is to dispel the shadows. So what did you do with Goldman Sachs when it came to the 10,000 small business initiative and your response with the Paycheck Protection Program?
Yeah, so what we recognized was, you know, early on, we felt like the PPP program was really going to be a resource grab from the largest banks who were going to go down their client books and start to serve, you know, those largest small business customers of theirs, as you would expect them to do. The incentives were there for the banks to look after their own books and to take care of their largest customers. And so very quickly on, we mounted a response to that by mobilizing some of our peer organizations around the country who are also mission-driven nonprofit lending organizations, many of whom, though, were not SBA lenders. So they didn't have the authorization to put out these PPP loans. And so we said to them, look, if you can work with your small business customers and help them package up these loans, help provide that pre-loan technical assistance, and then bring them to CRF, we can fund these loans and originate them on our paper. And what we're looking for in particular is really important and critical community nonprofit organizations, as well as, again, those small businesses, 20 and under employees, you know, a million and less in revenues, that are really the lifeblood of Main Street economies in communities across America. And so we had a network of over 100 organizations around the country seeking these deals for us and bringing them to CRF so that we could originate the PPP loans to the folks who were least likely to get them through the traditional financial system and through some of the larger banks.
So you use both a combination of technical assistance, meaning actual people helping these small businesses get ready, because most, I think it was Ron Shevlin on the show joked that no one went into business because they secretly wanted to be an accountant or a CFO. So they're ill prepared, you know, to put some of these pieces together. But then what did you use technologically, you know, behind the scenes to make this happen?
Yeah, so it's a great question. So for the past, you know, 6+ years, CRF has quietly been building a loan origination platform known as Spark. And Spark was really something developed internally at CRF. We do have a full software development team that's a part of our nonprofit organization. And as we became an SBA 7A lender, we realized this was an extremely difficult program to understand. And so we started building some technology around the program to try to more efficiently expedite our deployment of these SBA loans. Now, for quite a while, folks out on, you know, externally didn't have a ton of interest in SBA lending. And so our platform that we did commercialize about 4 years ago, again, sort of operated under the radar. When PPP hit and we had an automated process for validating these PPP loan packages, sending them off to the SBA, getting a loan number back through eTran automatically, that became enormously valuable to us. We like to call that our secret weapon, and how we were able to put through the volume of PPP loans that we did in the context of all of the other much, much larger lending institutions putting out these loans as well. So we're pleased to say we did about $5 billion in PPP loans, primarily focused on nonprofit organizations and very, very small businesses.
Wow. Do you know off the top of your head what your average loan size was to do that?
Yeah, for the nonprofits, it was a little bit bigger because these were established nonprofit organizations, employer nonprofits, et cetera. So for the nonprofits, it was around $200,000. For the for-profit businesses, it was around $27,000.
Wow. So you really did get deep down into the stack of those small businesses that needed that help.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Fantastic. So, you know, you're not just a nonprofit, which is amazing, but you act more like a fintech. Technologically, what else has CRF developed, and how do you support these small businesses and individuals technologically?
Yeah, so that Spark platform is one of our core tech products. We also have another platform called Connect to Capital, which is a marketplace platform for responsible small business loans offered by nonprofit organizations. So Connect to Capital, really our core insight was that, again, there's, you know, 1,000 or more of these community lending organizations around the country, but they're extremely difficult to find. The market is extremely fragmented, and these organizations don't really have any skills, technical skills, or resources to put towards marketing. So what we did was essentially aggregate all of the products offered by these nonprofit lending organizations in one spot, and then offer a single front door for small businesses to apply and get matched to these nonprofit loans that meet their needs, for their specific financing needs and business needs. And so, again, I think the core insight and value proposition there is bringing a whole new class of products to, particularly to underserved small businesses, in a way that hadn't been available to them before, because, you know, there's 1,000 individual organizations seeking these customers, and not really having a strong foundation in customer acquisition. So I think that Connect to Capital marketplace is another real core innovation of CRF's that we expect to grow significantly in years to come.
Fantastic. If people want to learn more about CRF and what it is you do, and maybe join in and helping support the mission, where can our listeners find out more?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for asking. So you can check us out at crfusa.com. And you can also check out Connect to Capital directly on its own website, which is connect2capital.com. And then for those interested in the Spark lending platform, that's out there at lendwithspark.com.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for taking the time to join us today. Really pleased that there are people like CRF Fund out there taking care of the lifeblood of America and Main Street small businesses.
You bet. Thank you so much for having us.
That's it for this week's show. And a special thanks again to Jack Henry Digital, the pioneer and creator of personal digital banking that helps community financial institutions translate their trust and live local personal service meaningfully into digital channels for the first time. Jack Henry Digital helps community financial institutions strategically differentiate their digital offering from the mega banks, the big techs, and the fintechs. Thanks to our sponsors who make this show possible, especially ones who are making such an important difference in the vital communities across the United States. Hey, if you like the show, share it at BreakingBanks1 on Twitter. Or, you know, give us a 5-star rating or a share in any of the places that you get your podcast. Again, that's a wrap for this week. Tune in next week for more Breaking Banks.
That's it for this week. If you like the show, make sure to give us a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast platform, or share it with a friend, or share it on social media.
You can listen to all of our more than 300 episodes, plus all of the other shows from Provoke.fm Media, and learn more about being a guest, a partner, or a sponsor, all at Provoke.fm.
We'll see you again next week with more Breaking Banks.